The Bill Myers Show podcast is sponsored by Clouser Drilling. They've been leading the way in Southern Oregon well drilling for over 50 years. Find out more about them at clouserdrilling.com. Quarter after 7, now time for the Outdoor Report. Mr. Outdoors and I were just talking about some of the things we were going to talk about this morning. Greg Roberts at rogueweather.com. How you doing, Greg? And you and I were talking about the monarchs here, and because this has been a big deal, Merkley has just been doing the happy dance this week with the feds declaring the monarch butterfly threatened. And Rick Manning, of course, is telling me you understand, though, that this will mean that if you have monarchs, that the feds are going to want to lock up a lot of coastal property here. And that could be something that maybe Merkley is all in favor of that, too. But arguably, there's another aspect of this, though, that I did not know until you told me, and you did a live post about this on Rogue Weather yesterday, and that has to do with the state at cross purposes with the federal government when it comes to monarchs, right? And yeah, there's a reason here, okay?
Yeah, monarchs are endangered now in Oregon, and I wouldn't put it just as threatened. It's beyond that. Monarch was the number one butterfly that we had here when I was growing up in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Monarchs were everywhere. When I was a kid, I actually grew monarch butterflies. It was easy to do. You get those big glass mayonnaise jars. You find the caterpillars mm-hmm. on the milkweed plants. You put the caterpillars in the jar. You keep supplying them with fresh milkweed. They'd be happy. They would eventually do their cocoons. They'd go through their chrysalis phase, and then out pops this beautiful monarch butterfly that I loved getting them on my fingers and carrying them outside and watching them fly away. And that was part of life growing up here in Southern Oregon. They were omnipresent. So was the milkweed they were dependent on. Then, in the 1990s, Oregon Department of Agriculture decided to declare milkweed a noxious...
A noxious invasive weed?
Non-native.
Yeah, non-native.
Basically.
Okay, so noxious, non-native. And so, essentially then...
That's the word I'm looking for.
Invasive.
Targeted it for eradication, and the word went out. So all farmers and agriculture, all cities, all everything immediately started eradicating milkweed. And then, if that wasn't enough, we had the explosion of growth, and we've talked about this in other things, mm-hmm. Pheasants, meadowlarks, habitat loss.
Right.
We turned thousands of acres of what had been open fields and milkweed in them to concrete, asphalt, and rocks. And I noticed by the mid-90s, I wasn't seeing nearly as many monarchs. And then when we got to the 2000s, it was rare to see them. And now, Bill, I can't even tell you how long it's been since I've seen a monarch butterfly here. So the irony of the feds now going, oh, well, we're going to step in and do something. This is locking the barn door decades after the horses were stolen. And the barn they're locking up, all full of cobwebs, and is collapsing. And there's nothing there really to protect anymore, in large part because of what states like Oregon did.
I had no idea that that was the case, and thanks for bringing that to the discussion. Now, I'm going to be talking with a landscape engineer, a landscape person, who next hour, and because a lot of people, in spite of the fact that milkweed, I guess, is considered noxious and invasive, they're planting it anyway, and they have lots of monarchs. You know, they have lots of monarchs. People are sending me the pictures of their particular areas, and they've got the chrysalis. They've shown the pictures, and they're showing their butterflies, you know, doing their thing, what they do. But, you know, it's amazing. You have one government agency going across purposes to another government agency, and you can't recover the monarch butterfly if you're requiring everybody to kill their food. It's just not going to happen, is it?
Yeah, because, you know, milkweed, especially in the life cycle of monarchs, to create monarch butterflies, milkweed is an essential. They have to have it.
Yeah, well, sounds like maybe we're going to have to get rid of that determination, or maybe there's a way to modify that some way. But, oh, my gosh.
Something, because, you know, again... We see a lot of endangered species stuff happen for a big variety of reasons. We've also seen the Endangered Species Act work spectacularly, especially in the case of bald eagles. But is one time where I have watched a species get driven to this point, and I would say it was government action that probably had the most to do with it.
All right. So the way I'm looking at this then, monarch butterfly, the problem with monarch butterflies, state of Oregon killed it when they ended up trying to, when we're going to say that milkweed, their food, is an invasive noxious weed. Okay, so you're not supposed to grow that. It's supposed to kill it all. And now we're going to have the federal government kill property owners then by saying, oh my gosh, there are monarchs by you. We're taking you over. You can almost see that happening, can't you?
Yeah, you almost can. And, you know, especially in light of, you know, some of the history with the Endangered Species Act and things that have happened with various types of species where they have done exactly that. Yeah. You know, I understand where the concern is at here, and I don't put it past our government to do those kind of things at all, because they will and they have. But, you know, this time it just, it blows my mind. And then again, Merkley is about as smart as a bag of rocks. And like I said, maybe he didn't know, or maybe he knows and he doesn't want people to connect the dots. But I connected the dots because I was like, what happened to our monarchs? Well, they declared milkweed noxious and invasive at the same time they were going after tansy ragwort and Russian star thistle and other types of things that, you know, actually really don't serve a benefit to anything. And so I got it. But when they put milkweed on that list,
yeah, you knew there was a problem coming. Now I get it with I get it with star thistle. I mean, you understand that that truly is insidious, horrible, not particularly beneficial. What I do get a little irritated by is the state of Oregon. Well, it's not native, right? Not native.
Right.
There are all sorts of things that have been around here for hundreds of years that were not necessarily technically native here, but they're here nonetheless. All right? I mean, can we just kind of stop getting our panties in a wad over that kind of thing just because it's non-native? If it's not causing problems, so what? It's kind of the way I'd look at it. What do you think?
Well, I'll put it in a way that other people can really understand, especially out of our star case that we've seen recently here in the last few decades. Basically, let's look at it like this. Oregon decides we're going to go down and cut out every single bit of forest, and then the feds show up and go, oh, well, the spotted owl, it's the same exact thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Mr. Outdoors with me, Greg Roberts at RogueWeather.com. Greg, why don't we shift the gears here? 199's open. It's going to be slow travel, slow and go there, one lane. Boss was telling me he goes there, you know, quite often through that area. He thought that area that had the big slide, he was watching it for years, waiting for it to come down, and I guess it finally did come down. Fortunately, nobody heard of that, huh?
Yeah, luckily, and, you know, again, Providence, whatever, when it happened in the middle of the night with very little traffic flow. Middle of the day, heavy traffic flow, might have been an entirely different circumstance.
Yeah, and they had to blow up. I guess they blew up some of the hill, brought more of it down, tried to reduce some of that. And
what they did, you know, it's kind of like when you have the ski patrols going out and blowing the snow to create avalanches so they don't inadvertently happen and people, you know, get injured or worse, get killed. Same exact principle here. It's like, okay, we got the slide going here. Let's put some charge to it and help it along so we can help stabilize that slope and then do what we need to do to get the highway open again.
Now then, are we looking for some heavy snow this weekend? What are you thinking about rain and snow?
Yes, and I'm going to tell you right now, based on everything we see in the data, what's projected to happen around Mount Shasta and impacting I-5. If I-5 stays open through the weekend, I'm going to be all kinds of shocked.
Really?
And I've been telling people now at Rogue Weather, and I'm going to tell this audience, if you need to travel between Reading and Ashland at any point from today through Monday, you better get that done today before 5 p.m. Because after 5 p.m. today, with what's coming in, and I lay all this out on the Rogue Weather page, all bets are off. We know there's going to be very heavy snow coming down, and I'm going to just talk about I-5 between Weed and Dunsmuir. There's going to be heavy snow coming down, potentially at the rate of 2 inches an hour tonight into tomorrow morning. There's going to be winds gusting to 60 miles an hour. The last time we had this set up in November, we got blizzard conditions and it shut down. I'm totally expecting the same thing to happen again, you know, with this incoming storm that's going to be hitting later today and then persisting into tomorrow with the snowfall. The wind side of it is already coming in. We have high wind warnings up at the coast. We also have high wind warnings for the Shasta Valley, not part of the winter storm warning. We're going to be seeing winds gusting 70 to 80 miles an hour on the southern Oregon coast and in the Shasta Valley. The inland areas, Jackson County, other inland areas, peak gusts are going to be 45 to 55.
Is that going to be shutting down the ski areas? Will that shut down the ski areas, more or less, when you see that?
It's certainly not going to help. I think reduced operations. Mm-hmm. Of course, tomorrow, Mount Ashland is opening up the Lithia chair at 10:30 in the morning. That is ahead of schedule. So they opened for the season ahead of schedule. They had planned to get Lithia chair open later in the Christmas vacation period. But honestly, I think with losing Ariel and seeing some of the congestion developing, they made the push and Forest Service signed off on it, and they have approval, and they will open Lithia chair, as I said, tomorrow morning at 10:30, and that should help spread people out more on the mountain. But yeah, I expect things are going to be very windy both today and tomorrow for Mount Ashland. Ariel chair was the chair most prone to being closed by wind. Well, Ariel's not running anyway. So,
all right, there we go. Now, before we take off here, Greg, I would just have to ask, if you are headed 199, we know it's going to be slow going because of that one-lane closure sort of situation there by the California border, though. Is it going to be a snowy or more of a rainy possibility going out there in the Illinois Valley and into California out to the coast?
Yeah, no, that's absolute rain.
Okay.
Excuse me, still holding on to last vestiges of the cold.
I get it. Mm-hmm.
The airflow coming at us is southerly, so it's warm. Snow levels, though, are probably going to be running 3,500 to 4,500 feet. Mm-hmm. So, yes, that means the Siskiyou is going to see some snow. The Cascades absolutely will. I'm about to leave to head up to Redmond, so I'm going to be finding out firsthand about Cascade conditions and then 97 through northern Klamath into Deschutes County. But, yeah, there will be impacting snow arriving for basically all of the mountain passes except the quad passes on I-5 between Grants Pass and Canyonville. Mm-hmm. It's going to be rain. And then everything headed out to the coast, it's going to be rain. So that's the situation, and we expect that's going to be the situation at least until the middle of next week.
All right. Greg Roberts at RogueWeather.com. Thank you for the report. We'll catch you next Friday if nothing explodes and breaks earlier.
Exactly.
All right. And RogueWeather.com. We appreciate you being on. Thanks, Greg. 728 at KMED and 99.3 KBXG. This is the Bill Myers Show. Jack Cashel is going to join me here in just a moment or two. And by the way, Oregon Truck and Auto Authority is a proud sponsor of this Outdoor Report every Friday morning at about this time. Oregon Truck and Auto Authority on Airway Drive in Medford.
Not sure what to buy your loved one for Christmas? You're hearing the Bill Myers Show on 106.3 KMED.
Looks like it's not just Joe Biden who is passing out pardons. I'm looking here in the Oregonian reporting on a case that happened in Medford the other day here. The headline, Judge Seeks Leniency for Oregon Man Who Shipped Marijuana Across Country After Inheriting the Business from His Dad. In June, Matthew Sacken pleaded guilty to the use of interstate facilities to promote or facilitate a racketeering enterprise. He inherited the Medford-based shipping business, and let's see, what was it? That was Pro Pack and Ship. Now it's been sold to another owner since that time. But Matthew Sacken tells U.S. District Judge Michael McShane, I felt an absolute duty to take care of everything that my dad left behind, and clearly it was more of a mess than I anticipated having to clean up. So he apologizes for doing the marijuana racket through his late father's business that he ended up inheriting. Sacken's defense lawyer saying his client was unaware his dad had been shipping the marijuana for customers, but he continued to do so. It's unfortunate, Sacken adds, that I found myself in that kind of predicament. I take full responsibility. I felt like I was kind of living a bad dream. So he pled guilty. The U.S. attorney sought a sentence of 3 years of federal probation after Sacken's lawyer, Justin Rosas. Oh, we remember Justin. Remember him. He argued for the smallest sanctions available. And Rosas said, Sacken has worked to help people every day as a wildland fire paramedic since he sold his dad's business and dreams of becoming a firefighter paramedic. And the judge appears to be siding with the defense, And it was being described as a crime of circumstance, or, you know, this is weird because the guy was caught red-handed with, you know, $1 million of weed in the business, whole ton of cash, a lot of firearms and all the sort of things, and he was a victim of circumstance. So apparently federal judges are now handing out the equivalent of pardons or minor sentences or minor commuting. We'll have to maybe talk about that a little bit later. And in the meanwhile, we have Joe Biden handing out 1,500 commutations and pardons there, too. And now our federal judges appear to be thinking that way, too. I guess more of the wokesters, right? It's 7:34. We'll catch up on the rest of the news here. Jack Cashel will join me here in a couple of minutes, okay?
Every working man wants a new trailer for Christmas.
And I'm on KMED.
7:37, Jack Cashel joins me. Great writer and author. Been reading him for years. First learned of him when he did, as far as I'm concerned, the definitive book on TWA Flight 800, which I believe was just called TWA Flight 800. And, yeah, this was after the CIA did that ridiculous. Yeah, the front of the plane blew off, and then it climbed. You know, does no airplane ever, when you blow the front of the nose off? I mean, just me thinking about that. Right, Jack? Welcome back to the show.
No, you're absolutely right. In fact, when and they only showed that video once, and what the CIA was doing, mucking about in a domestic airplane crash, is subject for further speculation. But yeah, every aviator I knew just laughed at it. This is ridiculous.
Yeah,
it can't happen. The plane, the center of gravity shifts immediately backwards, and a plane it flutters out of the sky, falls down, so you know, swirling into the sea.
Yeah, and when the center of gravity ends up changing and it ends up being tail heavy at that point, then
right,
your angle
right,
of attack
right.
it's too steep. It tries climbing and then immediately stalls. Boom, crashes to Earth.
Yeah.
You know.
That's right. And, you know, lots of people saw it, and all the radar supported that interpretation and of the missile interpretation, all the data. And with a real conspiracy theory, it stops being a theory when all indicators point in the exact same direction. That's what happened with TW-800. There's not such clarity with any other major conspiracy we know of, including JFK's assassination or 9/11 or whatever else you want to throw out there. All indicators at TW-800 point in the same direction, which means that the authorities had to be swatting them down like flies, you know, as each new bit of data showed up on the screen.
Yeah, and then they're coming out and saying, well, it was because of a spark in the fuel tank. And I remember even thinking logically back then, wait a minute, a spark in the fuel tank, you know, there's no oxygen or very little oxygen in the fuel tank because it's so rich with the fuel vapor that it wouldn't burn. You know, it needs air to do this. And
in fact, when my book came out in 2016, TWA Flight 800, the crash, cover up, and conspiracy, I got hundreds of emails from people inside the industries, and the angriest ones were from the mechanics who worked on center fuel tanks. They felt personally insulted by this whole concept, you know.
Yeah, well, of course, the government always figures they can dish up enough, faked up animations and throw it into their controlled news networks, which are also CIA operations a lot of times, it seems that way.
Yeah.
Which, of course, brings it to our latest one, which, given that you grew up in New Jersey. What do you think about the drones that are now coursing the air? First, the White House says, you know, they really aren't happening. So I'm thinking, gosh, people should then start shooting down what the White House says doesn't exist. And then they backed away from that, and now they're claiming they're manned. But what are you thinking on that?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I'm just going to tell you, start with a little story. It's a stupid story, but bear with me.
Okay.
In 1988, I don't know if you're familiar with New Jersey at all, but I was down the New Jersey shore, and it was Halloween, actually, October 31st. And I had to drive to Princeton, which is in the middle of the state, and it's where all the drones are. And instead of like taking the highway up and over, I decided to take the back roads through. And as I figure, if nothing else, there's not going to be traffic on these, you know, back state highways. And then I ran into this massive traffic jam. And I said, what is all this about? And then finally, I got to the town at the center of it. It's a town called Grover Mills, New Jersey. The date was October 1st, 1988. October 31st, rather, Halloween.
Oh, yeah.
On October 31st, 1938, the Martians landed in Grover Mills, New Jersey.
Yeah, in the Orson Welles radio drama.
Well,
yeah,
the world, mm-hmm. And they were having a 50th anniversary commemoration on the day. I just happened to be driving through there, and that recalled to mind. You know, because I grew up hearing about the stories, especially in New Jersey, from people, including my mother, who went into utter panic on hearing War of the Worlds, and were driven out into the street, and all kinds of crazy stuff. I mean, because in the original broadcast was very New Jersey specific. So they land in the middle of the state where the drones are being spotted now, and then they march up towards Newark and New York City. So that's what I was thinking. Not that it was a hoax or that it was anything like that.
Yeah, someone trying to punk the residents of New Jersey, right, with these drones.
Yeah, I think they're friendly. You know, when with TWA Flight 800, and this is the parallel, the United States Navy was running missile tests off the coast of New Jersey, off the coast of southern Long Island, and in that space that, in between those two designations. And it was being operated out of New Jersey, their test. And they were running them. They seemed kind of reckless. In retrospect, they were. I suppose you had to do them in a crowded airspace if you were going to test their ability to basically to take out alien, meaning enemy, rockets or, as we found out on September 11th, planes turned into missiles. They had to be able to take them out amidst the crowded aviation, traffic. Otherwise, it wouldn't be useful, which is why I presume they were testing them there. And they had been testing them for several weeks. I have a video of a test done on July 12th, 5 days before the actual shootdown of TWA 800. We know there's another one on July 7th, 5 days before that. And they were, of course, totally quiet about what they were doing, even after the fact, even after Flight 800 went down. We were not told. In fact, it was the opposite of being told. They lied just shamelessly about what had happened because they had to, I'm sure they'd said they had to protect the national security secrets so that they were developing this new Aegis missile system and, blah, 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 which is all true. But the real motive, I'm convinced, for them remaining quiet was to protect Bill Clinton's election chances in that November, because he had fought back from the political grave after November 1994.
Yep.
And now had a lead on Bob Dole, who's a pretty hapless candidate. And the only thing that could undo him was a military catastrophe that would reflect badly on his own, military lack of trust in Bill Clinton, draft dodger, et cetera. They did not like him, did not trust him. And I believe that to conceal that was the primary motivation for remaining quiet, suppressing all contrary facts about TWA Flight 800. And I suspect that, to me, what makes most sense about the drones is that they're ours, that they're doing some form of test, and that they just choose not to talk about it. And as I also learned, Bill, and once people in those positions, you know, sign any kind of security, NDA equivalent, they stick to them. They honor them.
This whole idea that you couldn't keep everybody quiet is nonsense, right?
It is, because, you know, I had, at some point, it was just about a year or so ago, I spoke to a group of Navy veterans about Flight 800, and I raised a question with them. I said, you know, I think the one good question I get that challenges the validity of my own thesis is that you could not keep that many people quiet, right? Now, if it was a submarine, that wouldn't be many people you had to keep quiet, only maybe a dozen or so. But on a ship, you know, and if it was a cruiser or something, it would be much more. And they kind of laughed at the question. They said, of course you can keep them quiet. They said they would have been shocked if anyone came forward under those circumstances, especially since people like me were the only people reporting on this, and I have no capability of protecting anyone. Right. So if someone came, you know, and confessed to me, I couldn't protect them for a minute. I mean, you know, like the New York Times could conceivably, if they chose to. I could not. I wouldn't even have it wouldn't even be within the range of possibilities for me. So that was very instructive for me, because I had that question myself. How do you keep these people quiet? Well, the one word, it's like the omerta of government employees, is tension.
Thank you. Yep. That's
Boy,
it.
That's a powerful hold on people.
You want the pension. You want the benefits. You want all the other goodies that you worked for all those years. You keep your mouth shut. Yep. That's it.
That's right.
Now, you may have some deathbed confessions eventually, you know, from some people, but, you know, that's about it. there's nothing else left.
I was hoping to get one out of Jim Kallstrom, who is the FBI head of investigation. And I thought he was the weak link. I thought he was the guy who would talk. But then I had this conversation with him. You know, he's since died. And so there was no deathbed, revelation. But this is a kind of a little silly story too. And in the lead up to the 2016 election, Kallstrom was on Fox, as their national security, analyst or whatever. And he was openly hostile to the Clintons. In fact, he even came around to literally endorsing Trump. And so I got a private investigator friend, gave me his address, and I sent him a classified letter a few weeks before the election. I said, Jim, the family members see you on Fox mocking the Clintons, I get these seething emails from family members saying, if you really want to do something about this election, why don't you come and tell the truth about TWA Flight 800 and the Clintons' role in suppressing that information? And so I send a letter, I send them a certified letter, and then I vote absentee, and I wanted to escape the noise around the election, especially since I live in a Democratic neighborhood, and I went to France for 2 weeks. Right? So I went to, and it matters where I went. I was in Nice, which is on the Mediterranean, the Riviera. And I'm sitting out on a bench one night with a bunch of French people on these other benches. And I get a call from Connecticut.
Uh-huh.
And the guy is, and I pick it up. I say, hello, Jack Ashel. He goes, Jack Ashel, this is Jim Kallstrom. How dare you? You know, blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, I'd heard that he was a profane and a bully, and he absolutely lived up to his reputation. Right? I mean, he started dropping F-bombs in the first sentence, and I could barely get him to slow down and stop. And finally I say, hold on, come on, Jim, we're on the same team here. We both want the same goal, blah, 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 blah. You know? How dare you? And then he calms down a bit. And then he says, okay, if it was a mechanical failure, what? Are you going to tell me the terrorist shot down the plane? I said, I wish it were terrorist, Jim. But when you look at all the information, it's inarguable that it was our Navy that shot down the plane. Damn, now he really went off, F-bomb. And then he goes, and here was the punchline. He goes, you know, you sound like that effing Pierre Salinger who held a press conference on the effing French Riviera, saying that the U.S. Navy shot down that airplane. And at which moment I thought to myself, thank God I didn't tell him where I was.
Which was on the French Riviera, yeah. Okay, kind of love.
We'd be at war with France if that had been the case, you know. And then the next day is like, it's All Saints Day, I guess. Yeah, it was like November 1. And I went to church, you know, it's a holy day. And I'm in church and I get a call. And I see it's from Connecticut, right? So I got to take the call. I got to step out, take the call. And it's Kallstrom again. I'm thinking, okay,
he's going to confess. He's going to say he's going to come forward, right? That's what you're thinking,
right? Mm-hmm. And he goes, who is this? I said, it's Jack Ashley. He goes, oh, there's a butt dial.
His phone had a guilty conscience. Is what's going on?
So, I mean, this is still, I mean, I hate to say it becomes silly, but
yeah,
this, you know, I had thought this, you know, for years, the greatest untold story in recent American history. However, in the last, you know, since 2016, since Trump entered the political arena, there's been one major cover up scandal after another. So TW800 is now maybe top 10, you know?
Yeah, exactly. But you see, it's just that it's old news, I guess, with how did they get people to quiet up? Why is it that we can't get people to come forward? So anyway, yeah. Let's put this on hold for just a second here, Jack, because then I want to bring you up to your latest book, which is Ashley, The Untold Story of the Women of January 6th. And you have a great piece in The American Thinker, about what they're doing now with the shooter of Ashley and the amazing bonuses and privileges. And it's almost, you know, it strikes me almost as a payoff. You can tell me more about that coming up. It is 7:52. I'll be right back with Jack Cashel.
When you hire a contractor.
And you're waking up with the Bill Myers Show.
Investigative journalist, author, Jack Cashel. I always enjoy talking with him because he's just kind of... kind of matter-of-factly, this is what I found out in my research, and his latest book, of course, is about Ashley Babbitt. What's the full title on that again, Jack? Welcome back.
It's called Ashley, The Untold Story of the Women of January 6th. And in a nutshell, I profiled 10 women, and two of them were killed that day, Ashley and Roseanne Boylan. And the other eight, all eight have been incarcerated.
No January 6th people have been pardoned by the Biden thing? Nothing, right?
Look, they have, a couple of them have had their sentences alleviated, but by the Fisher decision, the Supreme mm-hmm. Court decision. But at the end of the day, all eight of them were incarcerated. And I chose these women almost randomly, not knowing their fate when I started. I mean, so some of them had not been yet... process. Some of them hadn't even been arrested. So it was just odd that it all fell the way it did. And they all cooperated, which really impressed me because there was a lot of reasons for them not to, you know, just for fear of retaliation and that sort of thing.
In this article, in The American Thinker, Why Are Dems Appeasing the Cop Who Killed Ashley Babbitt? It's very thought-provoking. You also take it through the timeline, you know, of the shooting. And a lot of people don't realize that, you know, that Ashley in some ways was trying to alleviate the violence or trying to control that, telling the police there to call for backup as the windows were being smashed and things like that, right? A lot of people don't know that. They're just thinking that she was smashing a window and that had crawled through it, right, at that point.
She was, a 14-year Air Force veteran. In that time, she served in military police work, and she was an MP. I served for a time in that the D.C. Guard, the guard that was eventually deployed, and that's scandalous in itself, while it was delayed.
Yeah, and it's well known that she was like, sitting there and talking with the guards and the police and things like that, you know, kind of, you know, not friendly necessarily, but it's kind of a camaraderie sort of thing, given her background.
That's right. She identified with them, and she was the first person she walks down this long corridor, essentially by herself. She'd been in the building about 20 minutes. Honoring the rope lines like everyone else, you know, and being polite. She walks down this long corridor. There's one videographer trailing her, which is fortunate because, you know, he gets to become a key eyewitness to everything that happens. And then there's a crowd, rowdy kind of crowd that ends up following into that corridor a few minutes later. So for the first, and At the end of the corridor are these locked doors to what's called the speaker's lobby. There are three police officers in front of those doors facing out towards Ashley and the others who are coming. And so first they're friendly banter with the cops, and then the crowd gets there, and there are one or two provocateurs in that crowd who, whose you know, mission is, to me, not entirely clear. And so the one starts punching out the glass transoms between the officers that they're guarding on these doors that are half glass. And Ashley gets upset with the officers. They're not doing anything. They're not even trying to stop them. And she says, do your job. Call for backup, blah, 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 you know. And they don't. And then inexplicably, they just walk away. They leave the doors unguarded.
Wow.
And then
that astounds me, just that statement right there. Unless they got the order, hey, this is not your fight. Just let him go. I hope that wasn't the case.
There was coming, and they could probably see it coming up the stairs, a tactical unit, like a SWAT unit. But that left several minutes of a gap between when they left and when that other team arrived. And in that gap, this one guy takes a helmet, breaks out a glass, one piece of glass that big enough for someone to jump through, big enough for someone who was 5'2", 110 pounds to jump through. And Ashley is so upset with him, she literally punches him in the face and knocks his glasses off, right? And then now the crowd is all shoving in against these doors. And then that is when she jumps into this panel, empty panel. And then just without any warning, without any, stop or I'll shoot, with anything, Michael Byrd, Officer Lieutenant Michael Byrd, who is dressed in civilian clothes with a mask on, shoots and kills her. Bam. Just like that.
Warning, no nothing.
7 seconds between the time she punches the guy and the time she ends up getting shot and killed. She falls back into the corridor.
And bleeds out.
Now on the other side of that these doors is Byrd and several other police officers. There are no congressmen in there. They've all been cleared out. And the doors are barricaded to boot, right? So then Byrd gets on his radio, and he says, they're firing at us. They're shooting at us.
That was a lie.
He says, I think someone's been shot, right?
Yeah, he's the one that did the shooting, though.
He's the only shot that was fired that day.
Yeah.
It was by Michael Byrd. It is, the use of force experts who've looked at it said that it was violated every bit of, tactical training. And the law.
But he got a total pass on this. He got a total pass on this. You know, it's like nothing. No one has laid a glove on this guy. I can assure you, a typical city police officer in most any town, especially during the Black Lives Matter Summer of Love sort of thing, would have been strung up after that.
Oh, sure. Tell that to Derek Chauvin, who's serving 23 years in prison.
Exactly.
Not only was not a glove laid on him, but he was promoted. He was given a huge bonus. He was put up in executive housing for like 8 months. He took the summer off and they paid him anyhow. He was supposed to be like working from home or something, doing something or another. Now he's Captain Michael Byrd.
He's Captain Michael Byrd. Okay.
And it turns out that this correspondence has surfaced thanks to, I think it was Barry Loudermilk, congressman, who's been doing good work on this, where the Capitol, the high ups in the Democratic House leadership are pulling strings to appease Michael Byrd.
Is he extorting them in a way, or looking for favors somehow, or what's going on? What's the mechanism here we're talking about?
The best I can sum. I mean, here's what happened after 8 months of concealing his identity. You couldn't see him unless you really, really looked hard in all the videos that surfaced. And by the way, I never even interviewed the people on Ashley's side of the door. I mean, the cameraman, whatever, the guy was with her, never interviewed him. So as best I could figure, when he surfaces 8 months after the shooting, he's interviewed by Lester Holt, a very congenial black commentator friend at NBC. And Holt leads with this question, why were you in hiding for the last 8 months? And this is all rehearsed, you could tell. I mean, it's scripted. And Byrd responds, threats. And then Holt says, "What I knew what he was going to say next, right? Racist threats?
No.
Yes, racist threats. no one even saw him. You know, I mean, you had to be a total internet sleuth to even know that he was black. I mean, you would have had to look at this video for hours to know that much. And then, so what they did is they created a victim out of him. Otherwise, the only martyr coming out of January 6th is Ashley Babbitt, once the Brian Sicknick martyrdom
was exposed as a fraud, yeah.
Right. So now you have him not only as a hero cop, like the other hero cops were beating women and whatnot, but as a victim. And I say this, Bill, my father's a cop, so I've been writing articles in defense of police officers, you know, my whole career.
Yeah, you're very sensitive to this.
Chauvin.
Yeah, I get that. Sure.
But this was indefensible. And what made no sense at all was that not only were they not investigating him, they were coddling him. They were, as though he could turn on them and what upset that whole narrative. That maybe that's what they were afraid of.
Hmm. Didn't the IRS give him kid glove treatment too? Because he owed taxes,
yeah.
Didn't he?
Right. He was on file for being like something $56,000 in the hole a few years ago, and that figure has only continued to mount because the case remains open. So, the IRS has been coddling him. He was coddled his whole career. I mean, only in the miasma of the D.C. swamp, the DEI-infested swamp, could someone who had as terrible and checkered a career as Michael Byrd. He was involved in several reckless incidents before that should have gotten him fired.
Well, he left his gun in the bathroom one time, right? Didn't he leave his gun in the bathroom?
Yeah, he left his Glock in the bathroom of the visitor center. 20,000 people passed through there every day, including children, right? And another time, someone, teenagers, stole his car, and he just shot at the car. And, if he had killed a kid, he'd probably been held, liable for that. And some of his bullets hit a neighbor's house. I mean, so that, and those are, you had racial confrontations, you had other, a whole series of crimes and misdemeanors, and yet he kept getting promoted, and now he's Captain Michael Byrd.
Wow, wonderful. Nothing will get you a promotion faster than being a failure in Washington, D.C.,
apparently. That upside-down world, yeah. I mean, it's odd because a lot of the, and you see it in the, when you watch all the videos, you have people like Michael Byrd who are creatures of the swamp, who believe everything they've been told about Trump supporters and think that these are like Genghis Khan and, coming in with their hordes behind them. And then half the cops probably voted for Trump, right? And so they treat Trump supporters like human beings. And these mixed signals are confusing to the people who are in the Capitol or approaching the Capitol. Some cops are acting as tour guides, and other cops are defending the Capitol as though we're the Alamo, right? I mean, So when Roseanne Boylan dies 2 hours after
Ashley,
right, the Capitol, Ashley came in through an open window. Most people came in through open doors. The people have been walking in and out for 2 hours, and yet they're still defending this one entrance, this one tunnel entrance, like it was the Alamo. And that's where Roseanne Boylan gets killed. I mean, and she gets, actually, the police push these protesters out of the tunnel after gassing them, push them down the stairs. Roseanne ends up at the bottom of the pile, suffocating. By the time she's piled up the pile, the protesters pull the other protesters off her. She's probably dead or close to dead. Mm-hmm. And then a policewoman sees her. A black policewoman sees her, picks up a tree branch, and starts beating her over the top of the head with it while she's lying there, helpless. That's all captured on video. And that policewoman, Lila Morris, hasn't been disciplined. In fact, she was sent to the Super Bowl a month later to be honored as a hero. So many of the hero cops that we see, Harry Dunn, another story, but that's a long story.
Well, it almost is sounding here, Jack, and I'm just about out of time here, but the reason it sounds like that this has been about preserving the narrative of the insurrection above everything else, and if they lose that, Dems lose the cred? Is it as simple as that?
That's exactly right. So Michael Byrd is a protector of the party line, just like Lila Morris is, just like Fanone and Harry Dunn and all these collaborative cops who are willing to come out and play hero and get their medals and get their promotions. And meanwhile, right, so then you can present the Ashley Babbitts of the world. You just ignore Roseanne Boyle. No one even talks about her. The Ashley Babbitts of the world is, you know, insurrection is trying to break into the Capitol.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, on his first interview, there's Byrd saying that he saved countless lives, right? He talked about all the congressmen, and including a handicapped one, who were in the lobby with him. There were no congressmen.
They were gone. They were gone already. Yeah, we know about that. You know, why this is important, why it's important to realize what did happen and what hasn't been reported and the narrative that is trying to even to this day be preserved, is that there is a conversation about President Trump wanting to pardon many of these of these January 6th prisoners when he becomes president. And now I'm hearing a little bit of backing up from the Trump administration. Well, we're going to have to take them all on a case-by-case basis. Okay, I get it. If someone was truly one of the instigators, a true instigator going in there and causing trouble, okay, maybe there is something to be said. But I'm hoping that he's not going weak on this particular issue.
I don't think he will, because the evidence is so strong supporting him, and more and more of it's coming out. And, you know, for a long time, the people in authority on the Republican side were afraid to address this whole issue. You know, it was really disheartening in the beginning, because it was hard to get, you know, people on your side on this, you know. In fact, I remember I wrote something positive about January 6th, about 2 days after January 6th, and it was edited out of the article that I wrote it for. And I won't mention the publication, because it's a good publication, conservative publication. But, yeah, once they established the fake death of Brian Sicknick, the Capitol Police officer, the fake murder, I should say.
Yeah, Republicans got scared. Republicans got scared, right. And they were shaking in their boots right. Over this one. Yeah, okay.
That's right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's not good. Hopefully, hopefully we can remedy with this, okay, or remedy this error, okay? All right.
And a lot of them are coming around, and I think they're trying to overcompensate now for their timidity in the beginning. So I know the J6ers are looking forward to January 20th.
Why are Dems appeasing the cop who killed Ashley Babbitt? That's a very thought-provoking article today in the American Thinker, AmericanThinker.com.
Yeah.
We will link to that, and of course also the book Ashley with Jack Cashel. Jack, we appreciate the take as always. Thanks for being a good Jersey boy, talking the drones too. It's pretty interesting. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I would advise your listeners to go to my Substack, Jack Cashel Substack, and that's I've been turning out an article almost every other day there, so. It's a good place to catch up.
All right. I'm going to subscribe. I don't think I've subscribed to you till now, so I'll do that, okay?
Yeah.
Thanks, Jack.
Okay, super.
See you then.
Bye-bye.
10 minutes after 8. This is KMED, KMED HD1, Eagle Point, Medford, KBXG, Grants Pass. We're going to check the Kim Komando digital update. That's what I was thinking there. I'm kind of getting ahead of myself right now. And then back into the conversation about the monarch butterflies. We're going to talk with a landscape designer who talks about all the ways to actually help the monarchs without necessarily putting them on the endangered species list. We'll have a little bit of that. We'll have a Diner 62 quiz coming up. By the way, it's going to be a great question, because today is Dick Van Dyke's birthday. He's been in the news a lot. So we have a question about Dick Van Dyke that I know you're going to love. We'll get to that before 9.
Here's Lisa with Kelly's Automotive Service for Just-in-Time Appliance.
Recently, a small part went out on our dryer at home. My husband ordered the inexpensive part to fix it. 3 months and several wrong parts later, he...